session. Pierre, who will tell us about, I guess, atomic clocks, right?
Yes.
And how you can measure gravity with them.
Thanks, Mina. Well, I'm very pleased to be here today. It's my first time at the Perimeter Institute, and it's a very interesting place. So as my talk says, I will talk about optical atomic clocks and gravity measurements. So in this talk, I will first give you an introduction to optical clocks and how they work and why they can provide you such a high accuracy. And then I will go more specifically talk about our work at NRC, which is on the strontium ion. This is the clock, the optical clock we developed there. And then I will talk about a few applications of optical clocks that are just starting to appear. Like measurements of the gravitational potential and differences and the variation in Fermat constants. So if you look at this graph on the left, it shows you the evolution of the accuracy of clocks. So the higher, the better. So it's the daily discrepancy in seconds, so 10 minus 12 at the top, and per day, or if you look per in terms of 1 second discrepancy in terms of years, then it's a billion years for optical clocks that we have nowadays. But what you can see is that this evolution over the years of a very fast increase in accuracy, but associated with an increase in the frequency of the oscillators by 15 orders of magnitude here. The cesium atomic clocks are at 10 to the 10 level, 10 gigahertz. So this is one ingredient for having a very highly accurate clocks is to use high frequency. So, and another thing is very important is the quantum advantage. Maybe it has a different meaning from what I heard over lunch. So it's just to say that to use a quantum system is a great advantage for making a clock, because you end up with a system that is not an artifact. I mean, it has a frequency that depends on fundamental constants. And then if you pick the same atom as in transition, it's reproducible anywhere in the world and in the universe in principle, unless the constants change across the universe. And so it's they are the ideal references for a clock. And the SI second is currently defined as a hyperfine transition in cesium. So it's already an atomic clock, but in the microwave instead of being the optical. So we have a choice of many transitions and many atoms and ions. So you select a transition for a high optical frequency, a high frequency, but something you can deal with the current laser technology. So typically around 10 to 15 hertz. And then you want a forbidden transition, typically electric dipole forbidden, because you want very narrow line widths. To achieve high accuracy and high precision, you typically want very high Q lines, which is the ratio of the frequency of the transition divided by the line width. And 10 to the 15 is typical, even higher in some cases. And you can choose small sensitivity to external perturbations. You can't have everything at once. But I mean, different systems have various degrees of sensitivity to the various shifts. So those are some of the systems being studied or have been studied. Ion clocks have been around for a longer time. And so those are some of them being studied. And optical lattice clocks, there's 4 systems. And the two most popular ones are strontium and ytterbium. We study the strontium ion at NRC. And on So now that we have chosen our atom and with a high frequency, narrow line width, and so on and so forth, now we need to be able to harness that accuracy and use it to make a clock. So that presents a number of challenges, which I've outlined a few here. So the atomic motion, you really have to control the atomic motion if you want to be able to get the narrow line widths and the high stability and precision in your system. You have to be able to detect the forbidden transition. And you need ultra-stable laser sources in order to be able to probe these narrow transitions. And then you need to be able also to count the optical frequencies. This was a very serious challenge. And as David talked about this morning, there's femtocombs now to do this. But I would just mention that in passing. And obviously, you have to control and evaluate your systematic shifts if you want to have a high accuracy device. So let's a few words about controlling the atom motion. So laser cooling was really a breakthrough in the control of atoms. And this allowed all this development that we see today. So the Nobel Prize winners are in black and white here, related to the cooling. And I put Dave Wineland as well, because he got the Nobel Prize in 2012 for manipulation of quantum systems. And also because he was the first part of the team that was the first to report cooling in, on atoms, but here it's for trapped ion, not for neutral atoms. So the basic principle is that you have a strongly allowed transition and you shine a laser on the atoms that is red detuned from the line center. And what happens is that when the atoms or ions are moving toward the laser beam, they scatter more photons and they get more kick. When they move away, they get fewer kicks. So if you use an ensemble of lasers counterpropagating, then you can cool in all dimensions. And the lowest temperature you can get is given by this here. This is called the Doppler cooling. And it's typically millikelvin temperatures. There's other techniques for cooling, sideband cooling and Sisyphus cooling and various other things, but I won't discuss that. But they're allowed to go even lower in temperatures. So the other important advance was ion trapping. So you will see shortly why this is very important to be able to trap particles for a high accuracy clock. So this also gave Nobel Prizes to these two fellows, Hans Demelt and Wolfgang Paul. And this RF trap here is often called the RF Paul trap in honor of Wolfgang Paul. So the idea is that you can't trap a charged particle with static electric fields. You need, but you can do it if you have a variable electric fields, if you have RF electric fields. And then this is, so you apply this voltage between the ring electrode, between the two end caps, and that creates a pseudo potential that represented here. So this potential can be considered to be harmonic over a fairly wide area around the center of the trap. And then you can make a trap deep enough that the atom is confined to a volume that is smaller than a cubic wavelength of the wavelength of the transition, and also its motion within the well is quantized, and then the spacing between the quantum vibrational levels is the so-called circular motion, so it's the natural oscillation frequencies within the trap. So the benefits of ion trapping is you have no Doppler broadening. You can have unlimited interaction times because your particle is trapped in your lab, basically. And you have a well-controlled environment. You only have to control over a very small volume, not a big apparatus, just a micron size volume, basically. And uncertainties at a 10 minus 18 level are possible with these systems. So a few more words about what the effect of trapping is. So basically, it's an atom in a box. And so you can see that even if you have one particle only, like the single ion system, the average velocity of your particle is zero for each atom in the trap or for the one atom you have. So it is lab bound. But its motion is modulated at the natural motion frequencies within the trap, so at the circular frequencies. And what that does is it gives you a spectrum like this. In blue is the spectrum at 2 millikelvin temperature, about 2 megahertz wide of this particle. But in black is what you get when the particle is trapped. So you end up with a Doppler-free carrier, and then you end up with sidebands, the modulation sidebands. If you have enough resolution, a narrow laser, then you're able to select to only interrogate your Doppler-free line, and then you're in business to have a high accuracy system. But you can go further, and so here it's a well that is not very tight, so it's 0.4 megahertz oscillation frequency here. At 2 millikelvin. If you increase the tightness of the well, the frequency will increase, like 1 megahertz and 2 megahertz, and you see the side bands move out, obviously, but they become very small very quickly. Another way to achieve that is also to lower the temperature, and that also lowers the
width of the central line is set by...
It's zero. It's zero.
The width of the cavity of the light that you trap?
The line width of the...
The line width of the central...
This one?
Yeah.
In principle, it has no line width. It's bound to the Earth, if you like, and it's not moving. That frequency is not broadened or by anything.
Time broadening or anything like that?
Oh yes, it is. But by the so you could choose there's some like the ytterbium octuple transition has like years of lifetime. So no, in principle there's no broadening. Caused by this. So this is why it's so great to have this trapping effect. You still have motion and stuff, but it just creates sidebands, and these sidebands don't bother you if they're far enough. So, and the modulation is a typical like phase modulation effect, and it creates those modulation sidebands governed by the Bessel functions. And the argument, the modulation depth here is given by the wave vector of your laser beam, and then the extent of the wave function in the potential well. So that depends on temperature. And if the modulation is small, then only the carrier dominates. And this is what is shown here. This is what is called the Lambdicky condition. This is more important for people who deal with quantum computations. So just a few examples of ion traps. So the top left is a so-called n-cap trap. The electrodes are recessed because it's very convenient for optical access. And you also have the ring trap or the Paul trap, and also a linear trap here at Innsbruck for the calcium. So the three pictures here are the n-cap trap design at NPL in the UK, at NRC, this is ours, and at PTB in Germany. So now about the detection of forbidden transitions. It's actually not difficult to achieve, but it was a great idea that was essential in order to make this happen. So you can imagine that if you you have this very weak transition, the way we perform the experiment is we have a period where you cool the ion with a strong transition here, the blue transition on the short-lived level, and then you turn off all your lasers, and then you interrogate your transition with the narrow linewidth laser. But you can imagine that all that happens is one photon is being absorbed, and you can't detect that out of your laser beam, or one photon scattered in 4π steradian, also you won't see anything. So the phenomenon is amplified by simply looking at the scattering of the photons on the cooling transition. And here's an actual trace recorded with our strontium ion. So we record the fluorescence, and each time we interrogate the ion, we come and look with the cooling light. And then if this fluorescence, it means the ion remains in the ground state. So here on the top part of this graph is because the ion is in the ground state. And as soon as it goes in metastable state, you have no light scattered. And so each jump, each quantum jump, is one successful event in exciting your system. So this technique is called the quantum jump or electron shielding method. Now, to recover a usable signal from that, you have to repeat the experiment several times, and you build up the statistics and the probability of excitation. And then you can record spectra like this one. You just change your laser frequency and record like 20 times and see what fraction of times you were successful. And then you can recover your line shape. And this is how we also lock a laser to the transition by probing on each side of the resonance and measuring how many quantum jumps you get. So optical lattice clocks, I will just say a few words about this. They work on basically the same principle as single ion clocks, but you can trap many more atoms. So it was Hidetoshi Katori that came up with this idea and presented it in 2001 at a conference. He used to work with ions and thought that there was not much signal from ions. So he thought about this idea of instead using neutral atoms and an optical lattice created by light in order to trap your particles. Because trapping, again, is essential for these things to work very well. But there's a big problem. The trapping happens because of the light shift. So you create a lower potential well with the light and then to trap your atoms. But you can see that the shifts here are megahertz type shifts. But you want millihertz type uncertainty. So the trick is, and that's the key to this system, is to find a wavelength of the lattice that makes the shift of the lower and upper state of the clock transition equal to each other. And this is what these two curves are showing here. So this is a critical part of it. But it works. They managed to do it at very high accuracy. And here is the kind of spectrum you get from this clock. So you have your Doppler-free line at the line center, and you have your sidebands. Here, the sidebands are broadened and smeared for a couple of reasons. One is that the wells are very shallow, and then the spacing between the vibrational states is not constant, so you end up with several components instead. And the other thing is that it's a laser beam that's confining your atoms. And then, therefore, if you're in the center of the beam, you have more intensity. If you're further away, you have less intensity. So the well shape changes everywhere, and then you get the smearing. But you still get your Doppler-free resonance. And here's a comparison of the stability you get with the two different devices. So here's the Allen deviation. So it's basically a standard deviation type metric. And then it is written in a way that is sensitive to changes for different averaging times. So you're comparing, say, you measure for 10 seconds, and you compare every 10 seconds and see what the statistics is for that. And so you can see drifts. It's sensitive to drifts and stuff like that. So here we have, in red and green, it's for lattice clocks, this strontium and ytterbium lattice clocks. and see the stability is quite a bit better than for the aluminum strontium, about an order of magnitude. So what that means is how to read that graph is the uncertainty of the measurement as a function of averaging time. So here, after maybe a day of averaging, you get to the 10 minus 18 level with lattice clocks and to the 10 minus 17 level with ion clocks. In terms of accuracy, they're very comparable. You see, the records for accuracy are shown here. They were reported just a few weeks ago at a conference in Europe. And the aluminum ion is estimated to have an uncertainty of 1 part in 10 to the 18, and the ytterbium optical lattice clock is 1.2 part in 10 to the 18.
I have a question. Accuracy is not the same as stability.
Pardon me?
Accuracy is not the same as stability.
No.
So accuracy, how do you define accuracy? The reason that's confusing.
Yes, yes, it's a term. We should say precision, but it's common now to talk about accuracy for the evaluation of the uncertainty. So what I mean by accuracy is the uncertainty in the evaluation of your shifts. So you say a black body shift caused this much of, I can evaluate it. I have that much.
The absolute value, you mean, of the, this is the accuracy in measuring the absolute value of the
It's the accuracy in establishing, it's the accuracy in making your clock work with that kind of uncertainty. So you can reproduce the natural frequency with that uncertainty, but we don't know what that frequency is because there's no device to measure it with that kind of accuracy. But the Fountain clocks can do 1 part in 10 to 16.
Yeah, but how is it different from stability then?
Because stability is, so you have a clock that runs and you compare it to another clock and you see how low you can average before the line deviation starts to go up.
Yeah, but this is the confusing part.
Yeah.
Because accuracy is the same. You never measure, I mean, we had a discussion in the morning about units, but in reality, you never, units are irrelevant because you always measure dimensionless number, right? You always measure a dimensionless number. You always have to compare your frequency to something.
Yes.
So what does accuracy mean? If I'm not comparing my clock to something else, what?
Yes, but you take your uncertainty budget and you look at each source of uncertainty and you say, I can remove the black body shift. I can remove the micro motion shift at that level and that level. And then you make the budget and you say, well, I'm able to produce a natural frequency of this device, of this atom, with that uncertainty. But you don't know. And what does it mean? It means nothing actually by itself. You have to compare something else. But this, it just means we can realize a natural frequency of your clock with that uncertainty. But then when you compare it to another aluminum ion clock, a different one, then they should agree to that kind of level when you compare them to each other. So you can make two different devices and compare them. But the absolute accuracy is about 2 parts in 10 to 16 you can achieve because the cesium clocks are 2 parts in 10 to 16. So that's the definition of the size second. So that, I would say a few words about that too, but so that gives some pressure to the community to redefine the second in terms of an optical clock instead.
Finish that question first.
That's okay. I'm okay.
With these things, we sort of have some, maybe I don't understand completely what the Allen deviation is, but often when you look at the sort of uncertainty versus time, at some point it will start going up again.
It does, yes.
Does that happen?
They don't go far enough. The problem is, well, for the ion clocks, you'd have to measure for months.
Right.
And then, so practically, it's difficult to reach the point where the Allen deviation, where you see basically noise in your system that is beyond your measurement capability. So
that's a good thing. Okay.
Yes, it is. But yeah, if you measured long enough, yeah, you would see something. That's right. You're right. There would be the limit of the stability. Stable lasers, we need ultra stable lasers to see the very narrow lines. So the traditional way of doing this is to use ultra stable reference cavity. It's basically a bar of glass or a bar of single silicon crystal that is used as the spacer to create a very stable length, and you put mirrors on it. And then you shine the light on this, on one of the resonances, and then you recover the phase modulated with an electro-optic modulator device. You recover the reflected signal, you demodulate it, and then you end up with an error signal as shown on the bottom left there. So it's a very high signal-to-noise ratio discriminator that is very good for locking the laser right to the cavity. And by doing this properly, you can get Milliard's type, line width, with respect to the Fabry-Perot cavity. The problem becomes one of having a good cavity and with low noise. So here are some examples of reference cavities. The ones shown on the left are commercial ones. You can see there's lots of shielding, three layers of shielding for temperature stabilization. And we have here the silicon crystal cavity. It's a single crystal. So it has very nice properties in terms of drift because it's a crystal. They tune the temperature to zero thermal expansion coefficient and they're able to get a 10 minus 19 per second or so of drift rates with this system. So this is the system we have at NRC for the strontium ion clock. And we have the Fabry-Perot cavity is in the pink box there. And we have our laser, which is pre-stabilized on this first cavity and finally stabilize on the ultra-stable cavity afterwards. The optics on the left is just to distribute the light to the different parts of the experiment. So one thing of interest is that we also have a zero thermal expansion coefficient for our cavity. It's made of ULE material, ultra-low expansion glass. And so we measure the frequency of one mode as a function of temperature, and you can see this is maximum. And the maximum, in principle, the thermal expansion coefficient is zero. But we get about 2 parts in 10 to 11, given the uncertainty of the measurement. And then we operate the system there, so we don't have too much drift for that.
What's the isothermal creep?
Yes, so it turns out that the cavity is always shrinking. And I think it's the rearranging of the atoms in the glass. Just keeps going on and on and on. And so
this is at this rate.
That's the rate, yes. 10 millihertz per second in optical, but in fractional is 2 parts in 10 to 17. So the silicon is two orders of magnitude better than that. But the drawback of the silicon is that it's an infrared wavelength. So you would need an optical frequency comb just to operate your clock laser. And it's it makes it very complicated. But yeah, it's a piece of glass, so it's not absolutely stable. Dave Villeneuve talked about the combs this morning, so I just want to show what we did before. At NRC, we had a so-called frequency synthesis chain, very complex device. It used 5 CO2 lasers, had 10 phase lock loops, and all of this had to work all together at once to link the microwave frequencies to the optical frequencies. There were only a few in the world, two or three. At the time. So we were one of the rare labs to have one of those. And now since the femtocombs have come into being, then only one laser is needed and we can operate this much more efficiently than before. We can measure for hours and days. Before, 20 minutes was a feat. And the Nobel Prize was given to John Hall and Ted Hensch for this development. So now we have all the building blocks of our clock. We have our stabilized laser, ultra-stable laser, crustable laser locked to a quantum oscillator, which is laser cooled and trapped for the Doppler free resonance. And then with that, we can lock the laser frequency to this atom. And then we have the comb that allows us to count that frequency essentially and compare it to other devices or even to just give you the time. So that's a slide that Dave Villeneuve also showed this morning. It shows the evolution of the clocks over the years. And we have the cesium clocks and the fountains came, it's showed here in this shaded area around 1990. And then the accuracy was increased by two orders of magnitude since then. Now it's leveling off. It's very difficult to get more improvement. The technology is becoming mature. And you can see for the optical clock shown in cyan and red that the progress has been very rapid. And since we have the combs, then the progress is even more, well, not more rapid, but there's more labs working on it. And those are at a 10 minus 18 level is the last 2 points I've added them to the graph. They are the latest results for the accuracy. So it seems that the progress is pretty steady and continues. And for the strontium ion, the points are shown in red. So We'll now talk about more about our system. So this is our NCAP trap with the electrode structure shown on the right here. And when we trap a single ion, it looks like this. This is measured with ultra-low light, a high-sensitivity camera for low light levels. And you can see the electrodes here on each side. They are about 0.5 millimeter apart. So the energy level structure is shown on the left. It's quite a simple system. You have the clock transition between the S1/2 and D5/2. It's an electrocortical allowed transition. We have the cooling transition between the S1/2 and P1/2. And we need a repumper because the P1/2 can decay to the metastable D3/2 state. If you apply a magnetic field, the Zeeman spectrum of the clock transition is shown on the right there. And you can see that there is no line right at center. You only have symmetric pairs around line center. So to get rid of the linearism and shift, then you measure a pair of components and average that. And that gets rid of the linearism and shift. And we'll expand on that when I discuss the other frequency shifts. We also state prepare the ion in the ground state, so we have more stability from our system. We do that by using a clear out laser to bring the ion back to the ground state right away. And after we detected its state, and then we also do state preparation in the correct magnetic sublevel. And that gives us a stability of 3 × 10^15 at 1 second for this transform ion. So here's a list of common frequency shifts in ion clocks. So we have the stark shifts, and several things cause a stark shift. And the most important ones are the stark shifts caused by the trap itself, because you have these big RF fields around the ion. And so this causes micromotion. And also the thermal motion pushes the ion against the potential well and also causes stark shifts. You have black body radiation, laser light. The second order Doppler shift is caused by motion. So the same micromotion and circular motion also come back here. We have the electrocortical shift and the quadratic Zeeman shift caused by a magnetic field. And this one is really small for this transform ion. It's like parts in 10 to 19 with an uncertainty that is parts in 10 to 21. So it's not a problem at all for us. And you also can have shift by collisions. So a few words about the electrocortical shift. This used to be considered a roadblock, essentially, for the evolution of ion clocks, for some species, like mercury and strontium. But it turns out it was not such a big problem after all. We found a method to deal with this problem very effectively. So that's what I'm going to show here. This is the equation that shows the electrocortical shift. You have in Hertz, you have an interaction term that is proportional to the field gradient, electric field gradient, and the quadrupole moment. So in ion traps, as you noticed, we have these electrodes that are near the ion, and then they often have patch potentials or charges on them that creates a field gradient. And then we have a term that depends on the angle between the B field, which is the quantization axis, and the field gradient. And we have a term that depends on quantum numbers. So the method that was used in the past is to note that if you align the magnetic field along three mutually orthogonal directions of the magnetic field, then and you average these frequencies, then that makes this term go to zero. And the problem is it's not that easy to align your magnetic field in space with very high accuracy. So you have some uncertainty that remains. We have developed a method based on the quantum numbers instead. Here is a plot of the frequency shift as a function of mg prime square. And mg prime square is the magnetic sublevels of the upper state, of the d state. And you can see that it's very dislinear relationship, as you expect from this equation. And this is actual data that we took with our transform ion. So the first idea was simply to say look, this term, the square in square brackets, is equal to zero if you make these two things equal. And this is simply saying that mg prime square should be equal to 35 over 12 for a transform ion, because g prime equals 5/2. And you can do that easily. You just measure two pairs of components, and you just interpolate to that value, and then you get rid of the electrocortical shift. So this is one way of doing it. Another way that is perhaps more elegant is to note that if you sum over all the magnetic sublevels, this square bracket terms, it goes to zero. So all you have to do is measure six transitions that go to the six levels, and then you average them, and then you get rid of the heliocorticoidal shift. And this is what we do actually in our system. So here we have three traces. This is all recorded at the same time with magnetic sublevels of plus minus 1/2, 3/2, and 5/2. So covering all the magnetic sublevels of the D state. And then we just average. And we estimate that the uncertainty is at the level of 10 minus 20, limited by the tracking of the resonances and not by the method. Before we had 10 minus 14 type levels. The tensor stock shifts have the same type of dependence, so they're also canceled very efficiently with that method. So another shift of importance for ion clocks is the micromotion. So in the ideal case, you have your electrodes like this, and the ion sits right in the center. And at the center, the electric fields are zero in the ideal trap. But in practice, you have electric charges on the electrodes or in the system that would push on the ion. And in return, the potential would push against the ion and cause an electric field and a velocity. And so this is what we refer to as the micromotion shifts, any shifts that are related to the ion not being in the center. So they cause stock shift and second order Doppler shifts. The method used is usually the so-called minimization of micromotion. So we have electrodes here that we have added to what we have in our system, and we simply apply voltages, DC voltages on these electrodes in order to recenter the ion and minimize the micromotion sidebands. And we can get down to the 10 minus 17 level by doing that. But for the strontium ion, we can go further because of a special property of the clock transition. So here I plot the frequency shift of ion trap, which has large micromotion shifts, here about 35 hertz or so. And it turns out because the polarizability of the clock transition is negative, the stock shift is positive. While at the same time, the second order Doppler shift caused by the same micromotion is negative. So it's possible to find a frequency of the drive that allows you to make these two things equal, but they have opposite signs, so you can cancel them. And this was a way to measure delta alpha zero, and this is what we've done a few years ago. So it's a comparison here of two ion traps. The test trap has large micromotion shifts, and the reference traps has very well-controlled micromotion shifts, so we can take it as a reference. And what we did is we just compare them and vary the trap frequency of the test system. And you can see this dependence, which is the change in the second order Doppler shift. And then when they agree with each other, this is that magic RF drive frequency where the shifts cancel each other. And the relationship between delta alpha zero and omega naught is given here. And it's very simple. It depends on very well-known constants, like the electric charge, the mass of the ion, the speed of light, Planck's constant, and the clock transition frequency. So there are several benefits to this measurement for us. Note that in gray is the best theoretical measurement, theoretical determination for delta alpha zero, giving these values, this range of values for the trap frequency, where the shifts cancel. And in green is our measurement. So we have an improvement by a factor of 24 over the value of delta alpha zero. And delta alpha zero enters directly into the blackbody field evaluation and blackbody shift evaluation. So we got a big gain there. Another one that is obvious also is that we operate the trap at that frequency. And then so the shifts are canceled to a good level, maybe a factor of 200. So now our shifts go down to the 10 minus 19 level for the micromotion shifts. Thermal motion also has some micromotion shifts in it. And then we get a factor of 3 for that one. Another important shift, and it's the most important one that remains in our system, is the blackbody radiation shift. It's a stark shift like the other ones. Now we have, in addition, a correction, eta, which is called the dynamic correction, because delta alpha zero is for static, is the static response of the clock to the to electric fields, while the blackbody has a spectrum, so it's a dynamic response. But the correction is only 1% for strontium ion. So the uncertainty of the different parameters are shown below the equation. The mean square electric field at the ion gives you an uncertainty of 1 part in 10 to 17 in the current evaluation. Delta alpha zero was measured, as shown in the previous slide, 8 parts in 10 to 19. And from theory, eta is known quite well with the Parsons 1020. So we've started to investigate the temperature of the ion more precisely by using thermal imaging. So we built a dummy ion trap, which is very similar to the one we have in the real system. We can't measure it in the real system because we don't have transparent windows in the infrared. And then we painted some parts in with black paint in order to have more accuracy in the measurement of the temperatures. And here's a picture of that trap at the normal operating parameters of our system. Here we see temperature increases of about 10 degrees on the electrodes. But this has to be characterized before we can get a number out of this. To improve on this thermal problem, there are many solutions. You can also go to new trap designs like the one shown at the bottom here, where you really design it to avoid heating in your trap system, avoid dielectrics tricks as much as possible, and have good conductivity. And it's possible to go to the minus 18 level by designing this properly.
So the minus 18, it's cooled out. This is with a single ion.
Yes. So here's our uncertainty budget. So that's what I was saying earlier. We evaluate each effect, and we determine, we try to evaluate it. And like for the black body, we know we have this shift, 557 parsec 10^18. So we correct for that. And the uncertainty in the correction remains to be 11 parsec 10^18. So that's our uncertainty. And then you do the same for everything that you can think about, and you add them up, and then you get your total uncertainty. And we would say that this is the accuracy, but it's really an uncertainty evaluation. And here they're all ordered in order of decreasing importance, and you can see that the black body field evaluation is really dominant. Everything else is at 1 part in 10^18 or lower. So now a few words about applications. So I mentioned earlier that the clock is very sensitive to the second order Doppler shift. The equation is repeated here, and this was demonstrated more explicitly in this paper from NIST using the aluminum ion. So what they purposely moved the ion away from the center to create micromotion, and then they could record the change in frequency of their system. Just to give you an order of magnitude, if you move at 1 meter per second, you would have a frequency shift of 5.6 parts in 10^18. So you would think that's not a relativistic speed, but for the clock, it's bothersome, and you really don't want to have velocities like this that you don't measure or remove in your system. So another thing that clocks are sensitive to is, and good at measuring, is the change in potential, gravitational potential. So without going into details, if you change your clock, the height of your clock by 1 meter, you get a change in frequency by 1 part in 10^16. And this is quite important, actually, because for the strontium ion, for example, we are about 100 meters above ground. That gives you 10 minus 14. It's 4.6 hertz, so it's huge, really. Well, it's large for compared to what we want to do. And in fact, everybody reporting their atomic clocks to BIPM in France, everybody has to correct for the elevation and the gravitational potential, because otherwise the clocks wouldn't agree with each other. So you end up with this interesting realization that identical clocks in different places, or different potentials, all tick at different rates. And nobody has a clock that ticks at the same rate. Everybody has a different time. So that, there goes the universality of time. But that can be...
Can they measure the map, the GRACE map?
Yeah, they have the satellites, and then they see how the satellites... go apart and come together depending on the gravitational potential, and then they can map the whole Earth with that. It's kind of cool. So here's a demonstration of the gravitational redshift with aluminum ion clocks, the same ones I talked about earlier. So all they did is they put jacks underneath in one of the optical table and raised it by a foot, and then they could observe the change in frequency. So that's a popular demonstration because it's such a small height difference. There's been more measurements, a more accurate one done in Japan by the group of Ido Tishikatori, who came up with the idea of the lattice clocks. And he has many lattice clocks, so he can do all kinds of measurements. So he has them in two different labs, separated by about 15 kilometers, and their height difference is 15 meters. He was able to determine the height difference to five centimeters with these two clocks, in good agreement with spirit leveling, which is still better than the clocks. But it's a nice demonstration that what you can do.
Spirit leveling, you mean pressure? Like.
Yeah, so they go with surveying. So they go with the level and the sticks and they measure. And it's they're doing very well with that. But it's in some places where you have mountains and difficult terrains, then they have difficulty getting high accuracy, but the clocks don't care about what's going on. Another interesting fact is that there are solid earth tides. Not only the water moves, but we also move. And at NRC, we move by about 50 centimeters, sometimes from between day and night, depending on where the moon and the sun are. And so that becomes also an issue if you compare clocks which are separated by large distances, because you don't have the same tides at different places. So your clocks also vary in speed with time because of that. But this is well known, so you can correct for it. So we saw, Dave also discussed this variation of fundamental constants. So just a few words, it's basically for alpha dot. So you can write the frequency of a clock like this here, where you have a parameter Q that depends on the relativistic effect on your atoms, and then multiply by this term. So you can take the ratio of two frequencies, two different frequencies, or two different clocks, and then end up with this this equation that depends on sensitivity coefficients, K1 and K2, and the variation in alpha with time. So here are some of the Ks, the sensitivity coefficients for various systems. Aluminum is very light, so the relativistic shift are small, so you have a very small value. And on the contrary, ytterbium is heavy, so you have a large shift. And as discussed with Mina this morning, if you have nuclear clocks also have a very large sensitivity to alpha. So when this would come into being, then we'll have very tight tests of this variation of the fundamental constant. The best result is the aluminum versus mercury comparison done over 2 years at NIST. They give an uncertainty of 2 parts in this 17. So in general, the clock performance will keep improving. So it would be the stability, the accuracy. Also, long-term operation would become very important because they don't operate for very long right now. So the technology has to improve in order for these devices to become more practical. Many groups are building transportable optical clocks, and we are too. And so what we can compare clocks with other labs, because this is a challenge to compare clocks with very high accuracy. Here are some examples of what things you can do. In Europe, they're lucky. They have many fibers to compare the clocks, and this is the best way to do it. So the transportable and LEO is low orbit satellites. This doesn't exist yet. This is being worked on, is to compare clocks using laser beams, but reflected off satellites. So, and medium orbit is the GPS. This is what we use most of the time. And GEO is geostationary satellites. For the strontium ion, we want to evaluate the field of the ion for higher accuracy. We're building a new ion trap, and we're going to pay attention to having lower heating of the trap for higher accuracy. And we plan on doing many comparisons of the strontium clock with other systems through GPS or with our cesium fountain and with our new strontium clock and by transportation as well.
By the way, this is
HCI, highly charged ions.
Highly charged.
Sorry, yeah. So those as well, they have a very, the relativistic effect are large, so you have this more sensitivity to the fundamental constants as well. So as mentioned earlier also, because the clocks, optical clocks are so good compared to the microwave clocks, then people are talking about redefinition of an optical transition, using an optical transition for the SI second. And the fundamental test of, interesting a lot of people with these high accuracy devices, I name a few here. And the dark matter detection, I guess, seems to be an interesting one. So Derevi & Co. has proposed to use them as a a network of optical clocks in order to see if a topological defect would pass through the Earth. So thank you for your attention.
Wait, you should put gravitational wave detection up there.
Gravitational wave? I have to read about this.
No, because it's very interesting.
Yeah.
And I think, first of all, there you're guaranteed discovery. We know they're there. Let's say that. In principle, so we're discussing a bit briefly over lunch. There is this, we can discuss in principle, you have to go to space, but there is a frequency range between 1 hertz and 10 hertz, wherefore, the usual optical interferometers, you're very much affected by vibrational noise, seismic noise. For clocks, in particular atom interferometers, that's not necessarily the case. And the reason is the following. The way you would detect them for the way light interferometers work, you look at how the distance between two mirrors changes. Mm-hmm. Now you can replace the mirrors by two clocks, and then you see how the frequency of the clocks is modulated, similar to the measurement that you did, but now the frequency shift is imposed by the gravitational wave. So if you do it with the same laser, now the atoms are free falling. So you can do the atoms, if you do a fountain or a free falling experiment, they are not suspended by anything. So seismic noise is not a problem. Gravity gradient noise is a problem still, because if the wall next to the atom shakes and you gravitationally couple to it, there's still gonna be some noise.
Or you would think it's very small.
But... yeah, that's much smaller. And then what you would need to do, again, you're sensitive to the biggest the baseline can be, but Canada has many mines. So you can create that setup in a mine, in a long shaft, and you have an either an atomic clock or an atom interferometer, an atomic fountain, you need to fountains at the bottom and at the top. And then you would be measuring gravitational waves. At the frequency regime where you are guaranteed to have sources, and it's not accessible, at least for the time being, by ordinary interferometers, light interferometers. So it's complementary to LISA and LIGO. One to 10 hertz. I mean, there's sources, those frequencies have sources because we're discussing the objects that LIGO observed. At some point, they were far apart from each other. They were not on top of each other. They started in principle with very long periods of orbits. And also I should say that I know both Andre and Maxime.
Okay.
Topological dark matter, we have no way to produce it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You don't have a physical mechanism to do.
No.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, in principle, you get defects during a topological defects during a phase transition, but that requires you have more degrees of freedom than just you have more things than just those things, and because they are very big, it means the phase transition has to happen very late in the age of the universe, and no one has worked out. And usually, you actually get one of those defects per Hubble volume. So you may not even get enough. So yeah, that's the Keble mechanism. So every time you have a phase transition, you get one defect per Hubble volume at the time of the phase transition.
So the experimentalists are ahead of the theorists in this, and that they can measure something that you can't predict?
Yeah, exactly, kind of. Yeah, I would be very surprised if this would see anything. So,
you put a lot of your effort into this error budget, which is difficult for me to understand. But if you imagine you wanted to make a gravitometer, so you only wanted to measure, say, a gradient of
G.
Well, Yeah, we're measuring the heights sort of thing.
Yeah.
Remember this pothole detector that we want to make for a mere $1 million, or to find buried things, for example. So I guess it is little g, right?
Yeah. So traditional gravimeters are really good at doing this.
But so if you didn't care about the absolute value of a transition, but let's say you have two of these, like in the mine shaft.
Yeah.
It makes it a lot easier, right? Because you don't. So a lot of stuff cancels.
Yes, that's one way to look at it. But if you control your uncertainty well, then your two clocks will be identical. If you don't care about this systematic shift, then you're going to have to measure them against each other, see what the shift you have, and then and it's a bit dangerous. I would think to
not as easy as I.
Well, it's not that difficult to. It takes time to perfect the error budget, if you will. But many things we do, like tuning the trap frequency to this value, 14.4 megahertz, gives us a factor of 200 gain in the shift. You don't have to do anything. It's just there. And the electrical pole shift is the same. It's just part of the system. So this is canceled automatically. So we don't have to evaluate that many things to make it work to high accuracy. So it's a nice feature of that clock, actually. But then you ensure that you don't have funny things happen or change over time. Because if you don't control them well, they could change over time. And then you think you see something, but it could be your clock. So I would play the safe approach to that. I think interesting devices could be the silicon cavity, because it's not a perfect system, but they have less drift and all that. So it could allow you to do some work the clock would do.
Along those lines, if you were interrogating two clocks with the same laser that was locked in the same cavity.
Yes, that's true. You do get a lot of cancellation of. This is what Katori likes to do. He does that, and he gets much better stability of comparison of his two clocks. Yeah. So then you can do that, because you don't care about that.
Okay, Saint-Pierre again.